This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For people with family members who are schizophrenic, paranoid, and violent, there are often no good options. My guest, Mira Bartok, ran out of options with her schizophrenic mother, in spite of the social workers, the brief institutionalizations, and the attempts to become or appoint a legal guardian for her mother. In order to have a life and live in safety, she changed her name to Bartok so that her mother couldn't find her. Her mother was homeless for about 17 years, but for the last 3 years of her life, she lived in a women's shelter that is now named after her. In the new book, The Memory Palace, Mira Bartok describes what it's like to have a mother who is disconnected from reality. The memoir is also about Bartok's own traumatic brain injury from a car accident, which left her with memory loss and difficulty retaining new memories. Bartok has written many children's books. The Memory Palace is her first book for adults. Mira Bartok, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start with a reading from the book, and this is a reading about the car accident and the neurological impact it had on you and how that relates to your mother. So if you would read that excerpt for us.
Yes, I will. When the truck hit, I was in the passenger seat, leaning over, looking for a cassette. The man driving my car, who suffered whiplash in the accident, was a guy I was dating at the time. We were on our way home from my sister's house in northern New York. The truck driver, who must have fallen asleep, swerved toward the right and tried to put on his brakes. The next thing I recall was a pair of white-gloved hands reaching in to pull me out of the car. I remember a blur of blinking lights and the feeling of hot lava dripping down the back of my head. When I eventually told my mother about the accident, I said that I suffered from memory loss, mostly short-term, but some long-term memory as well, which isn't that common with traumatic brain injury. I didn't tell her about the strange sensations of lost time that one doctor thought might be temporal lobe seizures, or that I no longer could follow directions, that I didn't know how to leave a tip and had trouble reading, writing, and doing just about anything that required over 10 minutes of concentration. Why tell a homeless woman who slept at the airport that it felt like it was raining inside my body and ants were crawling up and down my legs? My mother thought there were rats living inside her body, aliens in her head.
Thanks for reading that. That's Mira Bartok reading an excerpt of her new memoir, The Memory Palace. Did it help you understand your mother at all to have neurological issues of your own after the accident?
Oh, absolutely. Especially in the way that it was very hard to, and it still is, hard to filter out sound coming in from other places, for instance, going to a restaurant and hearing a lot of noise or sitting at a dinner table with a lot of people having different conversations. And I know for my mother, you know, it would have been 10 million times worse. But things like that really made me understand her a little bit better.
And with your mother, she always had voices in her head that she couldn't filter out.
Right. I think at the end of her life, the doctors told me that she was probably about 90 to 95% delusional. So she was just constantly hearing voices.
Well, before we talk more about your mother and her schizophrenia, let's start with the medical issue that you've been dealing with. What are some of the long and short-term memory problems that you have now?
I forget. No. I think the largest impact is the short-term memory problems that affect me as a writer, because I'll write something one day and I have no memory of writing it the next. So I have to create rather elaborate systems of recall in order to actually know what I wrote and where I put whatever I wrote. And things like if I have a lot of distractions in the day, or I listen to people talk too much, or I get really tired, then I might get lost on the way home from a place that I've always gone to that's not too far away. I forget, you know, how to get home. So long-term memory, that has really come back a lot. And that's actually, long-term memory loss is rather rare with the kind of accident I have. However, some of the problems with my accident were probably compounded by the fact that I had some level of PTSD and had had a previous head injury several months before, so my brain was more vulnerable because of the second injury.
Do you feel like you became a different person after the accident when your memory was impaired and you had to recreate ways of remembering? There were probably things that never came back to you.
Absolutely. In some ways, yes. But I think the thing that changed the most wasn't necessarily memory, even though obviously I had some memory impairment and still do. It was more identity related in that I always thought of myself as some kind of person who can endure just about anything and had a boundless energy and could do several things at the same time, you know, draw while I'm listening to some language tape and learning a new language at the same time. I was very good at multitasking and was also very sociable and enjoyed spending time with a lot of people. And so I think what's been the largest change is that I just don't have that kind of endurance. I have to be pretty reclusive sometimes, which is kind of it's difficult for friends to understand and family too.
Let's talk about your mother. You describe her as she was the mad woman on the street brandishing a knife, the woman who shouts obscenities at you in the park, who follows you down alleyways, lighting matches in your hair. Did your mother really do all those things?
That's the worst. That would be a description of the worst of her behavior.
Including lighting matches in your hair?
No, that just happened to me once on a train. I was on a subway and some mentally ill woman did that to me. My mother did set chairs on fire though, but I don't think she ever set anyone's hair on fire. But, when she was at her worst, she was extremely delusional and could turn toward to violence, mostly to, in her mind, to protect me or my sister from enemies that she perceived were standing there in the room or outside the door. She would maybe threaten us in some way because she didn't want us to go outside or, you know, because Nazis might be there waiting for us. But she was also incredibly loving. People say that a schizophrenic's nature is still there, that the nature they were born with before the illness sort of stampedes into their life. And I really believe my mother was, you know, had a very kind and loving soul. It's just that the illness hijacked her brain.
She was also a piano prodigy.
Yeah, she was pretty incredible pianist.
When was the first time you realized that your mother could be violent and dangerous?
My first memory is in the book, and it's I'm about 5 years old, and of course maybe I saw this side of her before, but I don't remember it. It's very vague, as most memories are from early childhood, but I heard some kind of sound and laughter and just strange cackling in the living room, and my memory is really peering into the living room at this woman who is my mother but not my mother, sort of moving in circles, holding a knife and saying just, you know, babbling and laughing and saying and swearing. And it was just very disturbing. Obviously talking to someone who wasn't there.
What's the closest your mother came to harming you?
It was probably the last, if you called a family visit. My sister and I came to Cleveland in 1990 to try to convince our mother to voluntarily agree to sign guardianship papers so that we could get a legal guardian for her and thereby therefore place her in supervised housing. And she was so furious about this. We'd already taken it to court a couple times and lost. And she came after me with a broken bottle. And got very, I have a scar on my neck from it. She got very close to, she cut my neck, but it was a superficial cut, fortunately, because it was right in a very precarious place. But I got the bottle away from her.
When your mother started hearing voices, becoming delusional, acting violently, there was nobody in your home to intervene. Your father left when you were four.
Mm-hmm.
So you, your sister, and your mother ended up moving in with your grandparents. which sounds like it was no bargain. It sounds like your grandfather was pretty violent himself and had quite a temper. But were your grandparents able to keep your mother under control?
No. You know, my grandfather was very ignorant about, most people were ignorant about mental illness at that in that era, and he was extremely ignorant about mental illness and thought she was just acting crazy and wouldn't stop. And he had very little tolerance for her or her illness, even though I'm sure he loved her. And I also think he probably had some kind of undiagnosed illness himself, perhaps bipolar disorder or something. He had an extreme violent and violent streak. My grandmother, I loved her very much, but she was pretty inept. She was pretty, you know, she was abused physically by her husband and was also kind of unhelpful she was always afraid that the neighbors would hear about what's going on in the house. She was always very concerned about what the neighbors would think, and that often superseded any kind of action on her part to really react in time to help her mother. So, you know, very early on, my sister and I kind of put on adult clothing and really took on the responsibility of our mother.
Were people in your neighborhood afraid of your mother?
They grew more afraid of her. Sometimes she was, you know, schizophrenic sort of, at least the kind that my mother had. She was a paranoid schizophrenic, and she flip-flopped between a kind of intrusive behavior that was very intense and what they call positive behavior, but it's not positive. It's you know, violent behavior or hearing voices and all those things. She flip-flopped between that and detachment, what they call negative behavior, catatonic, depressed, barely leaving the house for days. And when she was in that state, she could last that way for 4 months, and then sometimes she'd come out of it. And sometimes she, you know, my mother would be very, very sweet. And I think that the people in my neighborhood, most of the ones who lived near us were incredibly kind and were often very helpful to her as much as they knew what was going on. And helped her sometimes even when there was, you know, something that was pretty scary going on.
So you, your sister, your mother moved in with your grandparents. Eventually your grandfather died, and then your grandmother got very sick and she needed to be moved to an elder care facility. And so your mother was on her own. Was that when she, like, really became homeless?
I placed my grandmother in this in elder care in 89, and then that year my mother went completely downhill, even where she was doing. It was hard to imagine her getting worse than she was, but she got worse. And so by 1990, long series of events, but she ended up becoming homeless when she lost the house that she had been living in. And then I didn't know where she was for 2 years until 1992.
You didn't know because you couldn't find her or because you didn't want to know?
I did want to know where she was. I didn't want her to know where I was. Apparently, she showed up in a friend's husband's office one day and demanded my address. But she wouldn't give hers. She wouldn't let anyone know where she was. But she gave a post office box. So that's when we started writing letters to each other.
Now, this is something I really want you to explain because it's such a horrible position to be in. You didn't want your mother to know where you were because she could be so abusive. I mean, it was dangerous for you. Yes?
Right. Yes.
But you loved your mother. You wanted her to be taken care of. But you couldn't be that person because you just couldn't, right? I mean, tell us why that was like an impossible situation for you. Why you thought it was like an unworkable situation to have your mother move in with you so that your mother wouldn't be homeless. And I ask this because we all see people on the street, many of whom we know that their families tried, to keep them, you know, at home, and it just, it was not possible.
Well, you know, when I was younger, this is in the 70s, 60s and 70s, there were like a couple community centers. One was called, I think, the Recovery Center by our house. And my mother went there and she was learning life skills. It was for the mentally ill. And she was learning, you know, she got better care. It wasn't great, but it was, you know, it was better. And she had a place to go to and she was in a support group and all these things. And but in 1980, you know, when Reagan came to office, a lot of funding dropped from for places like that. So my mother, little by little, began to lose the few support or safety nets that she had and that the family had to sort of, you know, my mother had this outlet that she could go to and she could get some, she had a doctor to talk to and once in a while, and she had, you know, she was learning things, how to take care of herself. So, you know, I think that the problem with so many people on the streets, it's just there's very little support system. And that was the problem for me. You know, my sister and I had taken this thing to court several times to try to get our mother a legal guardian because we lived in different states. Even if we wanted to take her in because of state-to-state law, we couldn't have. It would have taken 3 years. So a three-year waiting period. And each time the court denied our guardianship request because my mother could, she could buy her own cigarettes and she could cash her own checks.
I know there were times when you tried to get your mother committed to a mental institution, and you were able to do it for very short periods of time, but never for a long time. What were the problems there?
Well, you know, they used to keep people in mental institutions a lot longer, and as we know, and then, you know, then there was this huge release of everyone, and because I don't do memory, was it the 60s or 70s? I can't remember.
I think it was the 70s, and you're talking about the changing of the laws for institutions. Because
right.
So many of the mental institutions were so bad. They treated people so poorly. Institutionalization was seen as a very negative thing for many patients, but then things swung in the other direction where a lot of those patients ended up on the streets instead of in the mental institutions, so that didn't seem like the best solution, but that's the way it's the way it ended up for a lot of people.
Well, it's the way it ended up for my mother. I mean, theoretically, what was supposed to be in place of those institutions, you know, were community centers, like the place that helped my mother before, but those dwindled or weren't there, and so, you know, my mother got very little support from the social system that was available to her, and therefore she ended up on the street. So, you know, it was always really a difficult decision to try to get her institutionalized because I knew that certainly wasn't a great thing either. And I felt like I was betraying her in some way. And, you know, and it was some of these places were just terrible. But she would have harmed herself or harmed us. There was no real alternative. We just need to be safe, and we needed her. We needed somebody to keep her safe from killing herself.
But you couldn't be the ones to do that because then you wouldn't be safe.
No, it wouldn't be. I mean, my mother was so obsessed with my sister Natalia, then Rachel, and obsessed with me, and didn't. You know, her idea was that her plan, master plan, was that we three all go on government aid. We live in an apartment together, and we don't leave the apartment ever. And she had already, you know, in my adult life, shown up at various jobs, friends' houses. She'd call the police would show up at my door because my mother would, you know, call the local district and say that I was being raped or murdered. She would call 100 times a day. I mean, it was pretty horrible. I couldn't live like that, nor could my sister.
So the police almost suggested to you that you change your name and phone number and not tell your mother because she was driving them crazy because she'd always call the police to go check on you. Is that how you got the idea of changing your name?
I think it probably was first my sister's idea. My sister was in school, the graduate school at the time when that policeman made that suggestion to me. She knew that she was going to be out looking for professional jobs, you know, as a teaching English at a university. And there was no way she was going to have our mother show up and in her classroom. And, you know, she didn't want to lose her job. I think it was my sister's idea, but, you know, definitely the policeman, after he said that, I immediately got an unpublished phone number and wrote my mother a letter saying that I had moved, but I actually hadn't. This is before she ended up becoming homeless, but it was very close to that time.
So you changed your last name to Bartok after Bela Bartok, the composer.
Yes.
Who your mother probably introduced you to because she loved classical music and had been a piano prodigy. When I say introduced you to, I mean to his music, not to him as a person. So you severed ties with her. You changed your phone number. She didn't know your address. She didn't even know your name anymore. But you had a post office box for her. And then you had a post office box for yourself so she could send you letters that you would get through a friend who would check the post office box. At this point, you knew that she was homeless, that she was spending some time living on streets and parks and airports. And, you know, I'm sure, like, it's hard to live with that, even though you knew you couldn't live with her. How much did that eat at you? How difficult did it make your life to know what hell her life was?
I thought about it every day. I mean, I lived my life, and I made art, and I had jobs, and I had relationships. But, you know, there was a part of me that kept things rather private about that because, you know, you're at a party, and people are having conversations, and somebody turns to you and says, "What's your family like? What does your father do? What does your mother do?" She's homeless, and she's schizophrenic. I mean, that's cheerful. So, you know, I mean, I learned to change topics very quickly and just sort of in some ways compartmentalize that part of my life. But I thought about her all the time, constantly, and was always thinking about what I could, you know, how is she keeping warm? You know, what does she need? And I also was constantly sending her art supplies because I knew she had started drawing. And so I was always thinking about her.
Mira, I'd like you to read a letter that your mother wrote you while she was homeless and when you were communicating with each other through post office boxes. This is a letter that she sent to you on the back of a Dunkin' Donuts bag. Mm-hmm. And she sent it with a postcard from a Marc Chagall museum show because she loved going to museums even mm-hmm. when she was homeless. Would you read the letter for us?
Sure. "Dear daughter, I am trying to adjust to life with a white cane. Many years ago, there was a man in Cleveland who made a point of rap-tap-tapping by my way, but I am a little slow in the game of Simon Says. These days, I keep a journal. There is always the continuous anxiety of blanking out again, and I need to be reminded of myself constantly. One can't always rely on who is there, but on oneself. Within your sphere of interest, the painting you made for me in the 1980s called Selective Forgetfulness is missing, stolen, or confiscated. I have some complaints going, as you can imagine. By the way, when you translate the message in the above dots, you will learn 9 letters of the Braille alphabet. Note to your artist, the color pencils you sent are being used by yours truly. I thank you. P.S. When I have something nice to write about, I'll let you know. Love, Mother."
It's such a disjointed letter of kind of delusional non sequiturs. What do you make of a letter like that? What reading did you infer from it?
Well, on the one hand, if I separate myself emotionally, which is hard to do, from a literary point of view, you know, when I go through my mother's letters and her journals, I think they are like some kind of incredibly lyrical, hallucinatory bit of literature. I mean, I just think they're absolutely beautiful and very inspiring to me. On the other hand, I know that my mother saw signs in so many things, in numbers, in pictures, in things that she heard on the radio. And so, you know, I try to read into what was she thinking? Who's the man in Cleveland she's talking about? You know, what is Simon Says? You know, what does that mean to her? So I start getting into this sort of investigative mode in my brain, trying to understand my mother. And, you know, after reading 17 years of her diaries, I realize I have a little bit of a better sense of how she saw patterns in the universe. But still, you know, this is really a lot of things firing at once in her brain, and no one will ever know. So I guess I find them terrifying and beautiful and often very funny. My mother was not without a sense of humor.
For the last 3 years of your mother's life, she lived in a shelter for women in Cleveland. And when she was diagnosed with terminal cancer, the staff of the shelter tracked you down. And they called you, and you went to see her for the first time in 17 years. She was at this point about 80 and very sick. How was she different from what you'd remembered? And in her frail state, was she still violent?
No, you know, my sister and I both feel like we got the sweet part of our mother back. She was, and she was very, you know, she was medicated while she was in the hospital, medicated for her schizophrenia as well. And she was so happy that we were both there. My sister came a couple days after I arrived. And she didn't say that much. I mean, by then she was so ill, and it was very hard for her to speak. But I felt it was actually very peaceful to be with her. My only regret, one of many regrets, but one regret is that I wish that someone had sent me a photograph of her in her elder years, because I think that I might have tried to make, you know, physical contact with her sooner. In my mind, she was still this really aggressive person and dangerous person, where in reality, the last few years of her life, I think she was pretty, you know, infirmed in some ways.
Was there any part of you that was, and forgive me if this comes off the wrong way, but was there any part of you that was relieved when your mother died? Because her life had been, so much of her life had been so painful. She had been so threatening toward you when you were younger. And you were so worried about her in all the intervening years.
Absolutely. As horrible as that might sound to some people. I mean, my biggest nightmare was that she would die. I mean, imagine this. You have a mother out there, and she gave birth to you, and she loved you, and you loved her. And you have no idea where she is, and you won't even know when she dies or where she dies. And you'll never know. I mean, the fact that it was an amazing gift to be given this short period of time at the end of her life to be with her, and to know where she was and to know that she was well cared for. She was very loved at the shelter. The women really watched out for her, and the women came every single day. And so when she died,
came to the hospital, you know, to see her.
Yes. I mean, every day, you know, her bed was circled by these women from the shelter who called her grandma, even though she insisted she was sometimes 40 years old and sometimes 50. But, you know, I was really, even though I was just grief-stricken when she died and felt like I had not enough time with her, I definitely was relieved. And just to know that I was there at the end. And no longer had to think about this anymore.
The women's shelter where your mother spent the last 3 years of her life changed their name after she died, and they changed it to her name. It is now called the Norma Herr Women's Center. And on the website for the center, it explains why. It says, Norma was an elderly woman whose courage in the face of homelessness and mental illness served as an inspiration to other residents and to staff. What does it mean to you to hear that?
It's pretty extraordinary. I mean, my sister and I went in October, the end of October, for the reopening of the shelter. The shelter was in pretty bad condition and then got some Obama stimulus funding and a couple of the grants, and they were able to rebuild the shelter. Now it's just beautiful. And there was this ceremony. My sister and I were the keynote speakers, and there were people from the mayor's office and commissioners, and it was very emotional. You know, this place that, you know, I think my mother had been the oldest resident. It was... I'm still very phlegmont about it. I don't know. You know, I'm just very, and I, you know, and I've maintained, I keep in contact with them, and now I'm going to go there in next month, early next month, and do a poetry workshop with the women there. And it's just, I have this ongoing relationship with them, and it's really great. I mean, who knew that a little frail, very, very ill homeless woman would have her name on a building, a large building like that, in her honor, this one little person. It's pretty incredible.
I see so many homeless people in the street who are talking to themselves and who are arguing with people who don't exist in reality, or at least don't exist next to them. And, you know, I always wonder, like, who are they? How do they end up living on the street? Do they have family? What's their backstory? Who were they? What were they like before they became ill? When you run into somebody homeless on the street who is mentally ill, do you try to interact with them? Do you try to give them money or food or... What do you do? I think we all wonder, what are we supposed to do in the face of this?
I think most of the time, unless I'm in a hurry, and I know that sometimes these interactions can actually take time. And I know it sounds terrible, but sometimes I'm in a hurry, or I have to do something that requires a lot of concentration. And I know that sometimes one tiny little interaction with someone and listening to them will totally throw me off. But most of the time, if it's cold out, I go up to them. I ask if I can get them something hot to drink or something to eat. If it's hot out, I go. Sometimes I don't even ask. I just go and get them some cold water. One thing you don't think about that often is a lot of people living on the street don't hydrate enough. They're not drinking enough water, especially in the hot weather. And sometimes people don't even let them into their stores to get water. So that's always a concern. So I try to make eye contact. I ask them how they're doing. My first impulse is to get them some nourishment. And then it really depends on how it goes, because sometimes I'll give money. Sometimes I don't. Sometimes I just check, do you know where the nearest shelter is? I try to be aware of where the local shelters are. I treat them like a human because, you know, they are human. And every one of those people had a family at some point, had a mother, had a father. Perhaps they have children. They were loved at one time. And so I think I just try to do it my small part in asking. And just giving them a little dignity for the day.
Mira Bartok, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Mira Bartok's new memoir is called The Memory Palace. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Our interview was recorded last week. Tonight, the FX Network presents a new drama series called Lights Out, about a retired heavyweight boxer contemplating a comeback. Our TV critic David Bianculli says it's a very good show, and so far, a very good year for television.
I'm not sure what's going on here, but I definitely approve. In the first week of 2011, the Showtime cable network gave us the premiere of Episodes, the Matt LeBlanc comedy that may end up as the best new comedy series of the year. And now, in the second week of 2011, the FX network gives us Lights Out, which may well end up 50 weeks from now as the best new drama series of the year. This much fresh quality television so early in the year, I've never seen anything like it. But I love what I'm seeing. Lights Out, on the surface, has the same basic template as The Fighter, the new movie starring Mark Wahlberg. That film is about a boxer, his chance at a title shot, and the tough-as-nails, hot-tempered, loose-cannon family that's in his corner, for good and for bad. Same premise in Lights Out, except this time there are other issues involved, like money and mobsters. Lights Out is created by Warren Light, who ran season 2 of In Treatment for HBO. His more significant credit, though, and one that applies more directly, is that he wrote the fabulous Tony Award-winning Broadway play Sideman, about a jazz musician and his son. That play really dove into family dynamics in a big way, while also exploring and explaining an intense type of artistic dedication. What Sideman did with jazz, Lights Out does with boxing. The star of the TV series is Holt McElhaney, playing Patrick Leary, a heavyweight champ. In the opening scene, his wife Teresa, played by Catherine McCormick, begs him to retire after a brutal loss in the ring. He does, and the series cuts to 5 years later. Patrick's ex-boxer brother, played by Pablo Schreiber, is now his business manager. And their father runs a local boxing gym that Patrick bought with his prize money. But that money has all dried up, as Patrick admits while driving home his dad, played by a perfectly crusty Stacy Keach.
See my kid in the ring? I'm telling you, with a little time, Omar could go all the way.
I need to talk to you.
I mean, he reminds me of your brother coming up. Doesn't have the reach.
Did you know that was the IRS in today?
Well, I'll tell you what I told your brother. I've seen the IRS come after fighters all my life. You don't play cute with them. Whatever they say you owe, you just pay. You listen to me?
I'm broke, Dad.
What?
I got nothing to pay him with. It's all gone.
How?
I don't really know.
Does Teresa know?
No. She's not gonna.
And it's her fault in the first place. I mean, I love her, but there was big money on the table, and she took you out of the game.
McElhaney is totally believable as the former heavyweight. The actor has real experience as a boxer, which is obvious, but he's also got the weary credibility of someone who's been through a lot. For the same reason, I love that Keach was cast as the father. He played a washed-up boxer in Fat City, a movie made way back in 1972, and every line in his face seems to be acting the part. The rest of the supporting cast, the unsavory characters who help, hurt, or tempt Lights along the way, is just as good. Some are from The Wire or Oz. Others, like Bill Irwin, who's usually clowning around but plays it menacingly straight here as a white-collar mobster, are impeccably, inventively cast. FX sent out all 13 episodes of this first season for review, and it's obvious why. They keep getting better and better, and the path to the hoped-for comeback bout is anything but straightforward. Each episode ends, at the closing credits, with a boxing ring bell going off, like it's signaling the end of another round. And often, based on what you've just watched, it feels that way. You'll want to head back to your neutral corner and take a rest. Not only after the scenes that take place inside the ropes, but all of them. Lights Out is that intense and that good.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of TVWorthWatching.com and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews Amy Chua's controversial new memoir about her approach to parenting. This is Fresh Air. Amy Chua is a law professor at Yale who's written big think books on free market democracy and the fall of empires. Her new book, however, is a memoir called Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, which is about raising her two American daughters in what she describes as the Chinese way. Book critic Maureen Carrigan says that Chua's approach to parenting is controversial, even scary, but there's no question that her memoir is destined to be one of the most talked about books of the season.
Amy Chua may well be nuts. What kind of a mother hauls her then 7-year-old daughter's dollhouse out to the car and tells the kid that the dollhouse is going to be donated to the Salvation Army piece by piece if the daughter doesn't master a difficult piano composition by the next day? What kind of a mother informs her daughter that she's garbage, And what kind of a mother believes, as Chua tells readers she does, that an A-minus is a bad grade? The only activities your children should be permitted to do are those in which they can eventually win a medal, and that medal must be gold. What kind of a mother? Why, a mother who's raising her kids the Chinese rather than the Western way. In her new memoir, Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, Chua recounts her adventures in Chinese parenting. And nuts though she may be, she's also mesmerizing. Chua's voice is that of a jovial, erudite serial killer. Think Hannibal Lecter, who's explaining how he's going to fillet his next victim as though it's the most self-evidently normal behavior. That's the other gripping aspect of Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. There's method to Chua's madness, enough method to stir up self-doubt in readers who subscribe to more nurturing parenting styles. Trust me, Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother is going to be a book club and parenting blog phenomenon. There will be fevered debate over Chua's tough love strategies, which include ironclad bans on such Western indulgences as sleepovers, playdates, and any extracurricular activities except practicing musical instruments, which must be the violin or piano. When Chua married her husband, fellow Yale law professor and novelist Jed Rubenfeld, they agreed that their children would be raised Jewish and reared the Chinese way, in which punishingly hard work enforced by parents yields excellence. Excellence, in turn, yields satisfaction in what Chua calls a virtuous circle. The success of this strategy is hard to dispute. Older daughter Sophia is a piano prodigy who played Carnegie Hall when she was 14 or so. The second, more rebellious daughter, Lulu, is a gifted violinist. Chua rode the girls hard, making sure they practiced at least 3 hours a day, even on vacations, when she would call ahead to arrange access to pianos for Sophia in hotel lobby bars and basement storage rooms. Chua also rarely refrained from criticizing her daughters, and in one of the many provocative passages that fill her book, she explains, "Chinese parents can do things that would seem unimaginable, even legally actionable, to Westerners. Chinese mothers can say to their daughters, 'Hey, fatty, lose some weight.' By contrast, Western parents have to tiptoe around the issue, talking in terms of health and never, ever mentioning the F word, and their kids still end up in therapy for eating disorders and negative self-image. Western parents are concerned about their children's psyches. Chinese parents aren't. They assume strength, not fragility, and as a result, they behave very differently." I was on my living room couch reading the end of Chua's memoir when my 12-year-old daughter came downstairs and announced that she had done enough reading for one day and that since she had also practiced flute for 15 minutes, she was going to kick back and watch TV, in this case, a made-for-TV Disney movie. Chua tartly sums up the stereotypically Western Disney plot this way. In Disney movies, she says, the studious kid always has to have a breakdown and realize that life is not all about following rules and winning prizes and then take off her clothes and run into the ocean or something like that. But that's just Disney's way of appealing to all the people who never win any prizes. Winning prizes gives you opportunities, and that's freedom, not running into the ocean. I looked over at my daughter and had mixed feelings about her just chilling in front of the TV rather than plugging away in that virtuous circle of enforced practice. I guess I won't be sending out the invitations to Carnegie Hall anytime soon.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother by Amy Chua. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.